At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Bankers are, by nature, a cautious bunch because there isn't much room to play with when billions are on the line. But they lined up by the dozens yesterday to borrow money from the Fed. And that is how we know today the credit crisis is nowhere near done. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 19th of December, and it is good to have you with us. I'm going to trot out a couple of phrases here that we usually have to deal with only on days the Federal Reserve makes an interest rate announcement. The federal funds rate is what the Fed wants banks to charge each other for short-term loans. It's 4.25% right now. Remember that number. The discount rate is what the Fed itself charges those banks, 4.75% at the moment. Remember that one, too. You good so far? All right. Now, bearing that in mind, we told you last week the Fed wanted to try something new to unfreeze this country's credit markets. What they did was they had an auction, a cash auction. They held it yesterday. $20 billion was up for bid. Banks offering to pay the highest interest rates got the cash. Today, we learned how it went. Good would be the answer. Banks gobbled up the money, but they paid 4.65% interest for it. That is more than they would have had to pay if they just asked the bank next door for a loan. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay takes it from there.
More than 90 bankers turned up at the Fed's auction party this week. Banks were so desperate for government money that they asked for three times more than what the Fed was prepared to lend. Peter Cohen is a business professor at Babson College. He says the Fed's money was expensive, but the banks grabbed it because they're unwilling to lend to each other like they usually do.
Banks have lost confidence in each other. They've lost confidence in each other as credit risks.
Cohen says most banks are still sitting on mountains of losses from their investments in subprime mortgage securities. Many aren't fessing up to how badly they've been affected, so banks don't know who's a safe bet to lend to. Cohen says the Fed hopes its money will boost banks' confidence, and then maybe banks will start lending to each other again.
It's like setting a match and getting the motor started again. It's trying to prime the pump so it can sustain itself.
Not everyone is convinced that the banking system's engine is turning over yet. Vincent Reinhardt at the American Enterprise Institute used to run monetary policy at the Fed. He says banks that can't lend to each other are also less likely to lend to their customers.
We already see from opinion surveys of bankers that they're cutting back on their lending to businesses. And if there's a more widespread and pronounced cutback in credit, then that could affect spending. And we already have an economy that's growing pretty weakly.
Reinhardt says the Fed is giving itself several goes to get the engine humming. The next auction is tomorrow. Another $20 billion will get pumped into the banking system. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Down in Washington, the president signed that big energy bill today. Detroit is going to have to deal with the first fuel efficiency increases in more than three decades. People who want Mr. Bush's job, meanwhile, will be running themselves around Iowa and New Hampshire for another couple of weeks, where all those conversations at all those coffee shops are turning from the war to the economy. Matt Iglesias is an associate editor at The Atlantic magazine. Matt, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
You know, we spent all of the 2004 election and a good part of this year so far talking about the war in Iraq as a political issue, as the political issue, I guess. It's changed, though, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Polls have been coming out showing that Iraq is still the second most important issue in people's minds, but the economy has really shot up like a rocket and has started to take over the political conversation almost entirely.
Do you think it's the housing crisis and subprimes, or is there something else going on here?
Well, the housing crisis and the rise of the subprime issue have, I think, played a big role in it. Also, because we've shifted into a primary season, the candidates don't disagree with their opponents, who they're running against right now, that much about Iraq, so it's being talked about less.
How's this manifesting itself actually out there on the stump? I mean, what are Democrats doing and what are Republicans doing?
Well, Democrats are spending a lot of time talking about new plans that they've come up with to help try and deal with this foreclosure crisis, and also emphasizing their plans for health care reform, which they see as an important way to relieve the economic distress affecting ordinary Americans. Republicans are more focused on trying to project optimism about the economy, saying that things are still fundamentally strong, and talking about further reductions in taxes as a way to help people.
What's your take on how that's going to play out there?
The evidence suggests that most people are quite pessimistic about the economic situation. A majority, I believe, think we're already in a recession, which we'll have to wait for the official statistics to see. And also people think the economy is getting worse. Republican primary voters are more optimistic than most Americans, which is pushing Republicans to take a very rosy view of things. But it's a view that's out of step with ordinary people.
Do you think this is going to translate, as we get into the election season, a little bit more into some of the more arcane economic issues coming up, like trade policy and tax policy and all that sort of second-tier headline stuff?
Well, tax policy would definitely be a general election issue, and you see the Republicans right now sort of quarreling with each other to see who has the most pure record. In fact, one of the big knocks against Mike Huckabee, who sort of exploded out of nowhere onto the Republican scene, is that he did raise some taxes in order to balance budgets as governor of Arkansas. So they'll definitely keep talking about that.
Let me ask you this, though. You referred to the fact that we're in sort of primary season now. As we move past the 5th of February, the big primary election day, and into the general election, is the war going to come back up, or is the economy going to keep its sort of hold on the electorate?
Well, the economy will almost certainly be a huge issue, but the war should come back into focus once a Democrat is running against a Republican, because I think you'll expect to see a sharper contrast between the two candidates' views there.
Matt Iglesias is an associate editor at The Atlantic magazine. He blogs for him, too. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There was another sign today of just how enormous the video game business is. One of the big names from movies and television says he wants in. Jerry Bruckheimer has signed on to produce video games for MTV. MTV and its parent company Viacom are pouring $500 million into interactive entertainment. They're hoping Bruckheimer can do for them what he did for CSI and Pirates of the Caribbean. Jeremy Hobson reports.
It's easy to figure out what's in it for Bruckheimer. The video game market is $35 billion a year and growing, and the games themselves are cheap to make. As Wedbush Morgan analyst Michael Pachter puts it,
there's no Tom Cruise or Johnny Depp to pay.
Nor are there elaborate sets or expensive special effects. Here's entertainment industry analyst Hal Vogel.
It takes maybe a top-notch video game, $20 million, to put that together, to make a Jerry Bruckheimer film, $150 to $200 million.
Vogel says for MTV, which is just getting into the game business, choosing Bruckheimer makes sense as well. He knows how to tell a story, how to develop characters, and he's a master of visual effects.
If you had to make a good first choice, he would be the one.
And video games are looking and sounding more like feature films every day. But some aren't quite so sure Bruckheimer's skills will translate to interactive media. One of them is gaming analyst Billy Pigeon.
What I'm concerned about is directors and writers and trying to control the process in a narrative fashion when it is not really a narrative medium.
And Bruckheimer won't have the help of the popular stories and characters he's become famous for. He'll be developing games from scratch. If the experiment works, analysts say, you'll know it when his video game characters show up on the big screen. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Wall Street bounced around a bit today at the open and at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you're among the multitudes out there who are counting on internet shopping to save your holiday season, best to ask yourself this first. When was the last time you scanned your computer for viruses? Because if you haven't, you might want to. One of the most pernicious viruses to hit PCs this year is called Stormworm, and it has e-commerce in its DNA. Ed Skotas tracks bugs like these for a living. Ed, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us about Stormworm. What is it? Where did it come from? And how long has it been around?
Stormworm's been around for just about a year now. It came from some folks associated with organized crime. They released this piece of software by sending it out in an email blast. It's called the Stormworm because the original title of the email was associated with some heavy storms in Europe early in 2007. And it's spread to several million machines now.
Hmm. What makes it different, though, than your average run-of-the-mill, you know, computer worm that you get that messes you up for a day or two and you move on?
Well, when it first started out, it was pretty run-of-the-mill. And I remember seeing it, and it's, yeah, yet another worm, just the storm worm. But the business model behind it has fueled its innovation. The bad guys are making money from this one, and they keep putting more and more features and functions into it. And one of the big things about the Stormworm is in the last month or so, it started to defend itself. It noticed if somebody was trying to access it across the network to analyze it, if the good guys were investigating it, it would automatically detect that, send a signal out to other infected machines, and then launch a flood of the investigator's machine.
A couple of things that are prompted by your statement here that the bad guys are making money. First of all, how are they doing it? What is the business model?
There's actually several business models. I mean, some of the more benign ones, although still annoying, are simply to pop up advertisements as you surf the net. Other ways that they make money is to turn your system into a mail relay. So they will start sending email through your machine so that it can spam other systems out on the net. Those aren't so bad. The much more insidious ones are the keystroke loggers. And Storm has a keystroke logger capability built into it.
Now, let's remind people what keystroke loggers are.
Sure. A keystroke logger is something that watches you as you surf the net, looks at what sites you're going to, and then records your keystrokes when you're at that site. So it'll grab your account numbers and your passwords from those sites and then send them off to the attacker.
In a way, the computer virus industry is sort of a self-perpetuating thing, right? You've got the bad guys trying to think of something new, which makes the good guys think of something better, which makes the bad guys think of something better.
It's something like an arms race. It sure is. And one of the things that we've seen happen in just the last 4 years or so is this shift to the money-making by the bad guys. If you go back 5 years ago, most of the viruses and related tools, worms and bots and so forth, were done by hobbyists. And now the attackers are focused on making money. And there's a feedback loop. They make some money from their malware. They take some of that money and reinvest it into research and development so that they can make their malware stickier, more powerful, and, well, improve their business model. You just referred to it as the virus industry. And really, there is a malicious code industry with a research budget now. Hmm. It's quite an amazing thing.
Ed Skotas is an instructor with the SANS Institute. He's also with the consulting firm Intel Guardians. Ed, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you kindly.
There is a wee bit of good news about the housing market to pass on today. The number of foreclosure filings actually fell last month, off a tidy 10%, but that still does add up to more than 200,000 homes in danger of being lost. And it's a pretty serious indicator that homeowners with subprime loans are still under a lot of pressure. Steve Tripoli's been covering the consumer subprime fallout for us, and one of the things he's found is people increasingly swamped by a second wave of debt distress.
If you track this mess from household to neighborhood to nation, you'll understand why every day it's looking like more than a passing storm. Let's start with a homeowner.
We're going down to the second floor, and I made a half glass floor so you can see through to the bottom of the building.
Bruce doesn't want his last name used. His debt woes are tied up in court. But he's proud to show off all the work he's put into his Boston row house over 21 years.
Plus, each floor has a deck. It's a beautiful place to live.
His trouble started with a period of missed work. Bruce needed money to pay his bills, so last year he refinanced his mortgage. He describes the deal haltingly, his head in his hands. Stress is eating him up.
I just needed to get the loan so my creditors wouldn't be on top of me.
A giant nationwide lender was happy to refinance the house, no income documentation required. Bruce asked us to omit the firm's name. The broker was friendly, and Bruce assumed the company's size meant he was in good hands.
I didn't read very much about the loan because I'm assuming it's going to be a good loan.
That was a big mistake. Bruce soon had a subprime, interest-only, adjustable-rate mortgage with rapid payment adjustments. Before he knew it, a monthly payment around $1,500 had nearly doubled. At $2,800, it was way beyond what he could afford.
That's impossible. I can't get close to that.
Bruce visited a financial counselor recently. He says he only learned then that the loan application he'd signed had grossly overstated his income. So now the house is dropping in value, leaving no more equity to tap, and Bruce has been leaning on a stack of credit cards to keep up with the mortgage, but they're all maxed out.
And it was just, the well ran dry.
Leaving him in foreclosure and bankruptcy. Now, multiply that kind of distress by a few million households and you get a sense of what a large slice of America is experiencing these days. Up in northern New England, I spoke with Dave Diesel at Vermont and New Hampshire's Consumer Credit Counseling Service. He says loads of the agency's clients with mortgage trouble are heading down Bruce's path.
They are increasingly using their credit cards to pay for daily living expenses, you know, using that as a way to free up cash flow, so to speak, to be able to make the mortgage payment.
Is that working for them?
No.
Don't forget, a big slice of credit card debt also carries subprime interest rates. It's not for nothing that the term debt spiral sounds a lot like death spiral. Diesel says his clients are simply out of wiggle room.
What we're finding is that people are stretched so much to the limit. The rubber band is stretched as far as it'll go. So any kind of sort of bump in the road begins an avalanche of trouble that's really hard to get out of.
What's next for households? Well, we learned this month that auto and student loan delinquencies are also rising fast. The whole mess is also weighing on Wall Street and the broader economy. On the credit card front, we already know that companies from Citigroup to Capital One are expecting sharply higher delinquencies. Dennis Maroney is at Tower Group, a research firm owned by MasterCard. He says lenders are padding cash reserves to meet rising defaults, but lately they're not doing it fast enough.
So what that suggests to me, at least, is that if the rate of delinquencies is growing at a faster pace, it would suggest there might be some potential risk for certain institutions going out into the future.
Mortgage lenders have already racked up tens of billions in losses. With credit card and other lenders also bulking up loss reserves, they're sucking up cash the rest of the economy could use. Dennis Maroney sees danger in that direction, too.
It could mean a further tightening of credit, which means that the lending of different various products that drive the economy, because we are a credit-driven economy, would be adversely affected.
Less credit, less growth, a recession signal. So pick your poison. Consumers are carrying a staggering debt load. The finance world's groaning under its own debt problems, and working out of those woes might rattle markets, worsen a credit crunch, or both. Most Americans seem to be riding out the crisis, but a large slice of America is struggling to stay afloat. And the next wave of this crisis is just starting to roll ashore. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Coming up, when parents tell their kids to wash their hands, brush their teeth, and go to the spa.
It helps them realize that you do need to take care of yourself. You know, you get your hair cut and you do your nails and you feel good about yourself.
Oh, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 25 points today, nearly 0.2% to end at 13,207. The NASDAQ gained nearly 5 points, almost 0.2% to close at 2601. The S&P 500 lost nearly 2 points, 0.1% to finish at 1453. Morgan Stanley ballooned more than 4% today despite reporting a hefty loss this morning. The stock lifted on the news that China's sovereign wealth fund plunked down 5 billion simoleons to acquire a stake in the firm. Oracle slashed off 2.3% before today's close. After the bell, the software giant announced that quarterly profits rose 35%. Those nagging fears that managers were scaling back on technology purchases apparently weren't realized. Overseas, the markets were mixed, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Days Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board reports its monthly index of leading economic indicators. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the third quarter gross domestic product. And the House Judiciary Committee holds a hearing on federal criminal laws regarding interrogation of detainees. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Time magazine announced its Person of the Year. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin beat out Al Gore, J.K. Rowling, Chinese President Hu Jintao, and General David Petraeus for the honor. To quote the magazine, Putin has put his country back on the map. Commentator David Frum agrees with that, but he says Putin is driving Russia to a dangerous place.
Vladimir Putin has wielded increasingly absolute power in Russia for a decade. And now he seems likely to wield it for many more years to come. Putin's term as president was scheduled to end this spring. But for some time, it has been apparent that things would not end so neatly. In heavily manipulated elections this month, Putin's party, United Russia, won a huge majority in the Russian parliament. This week, Putin's hand-picked president-designate requested that Putin take the job of prime minister at the head of this majority. Putin agreed. Things have a way of working out like this for Vladimir Putin. Consider the maneuvers that brought him to power in the first place. In 1998, Putin was named to head the Russian security police, the successor to the KGB. Soon, a series of humiliating or scandalous leaks disgraced leading Russian politicians, from President Yeltsin down. Then, in August 1999, Putin rose from control of the secret police to control of the whole Russian state. One morning, President Yeltsin named Putin as one of three deputy prime ministers. The government of the moment, that same day, abruptly resigned, leaving Putin as sole acting prime minister. Later, on that same day, Yeltsin declared that he wished to see Putin succeed him. Before nightfall, Putin unveiled his own presidential campaign. 6 months later, Putin became acting president. Putin granted Yeltsin and his family immunity from prosecution. Shortly before the 2007 parliamentary elections, Putin filed an official disclosure form listing cash assets of about $120,000. But Swedish economist Anders Oslund, generally one of the best-informed Russia watchers in the West, this week floated an estimate that Putin's personal fortune may amount to $40 billion. Who's right? Who knows? Russia, which once seemed to be evolving into something like a normal country, has retreated into enigma and authoritarianism. Political dissidents are again dying mysterious deaths. Threats again issue against Russia's neighbors. This is President Putin's legacy and Prime Minister Putin's inheritance.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also an advisor to Rudy Giuliani's presidential campaign. You can send us your thoughts online. Our website is marketplace.org. Every now and then, you run across an item in the news that just makes you say, oh, come on. And this next one might be it for you, because it sort of was for me. It seems pampering, as in manicures and facials, knows no age. There are nearly 5 million pint-sized primpers hitting spas every year in this country, and the budding self-indulgence set is also hoping for spa toys under the Christmas tree. Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
It's fun to do it together.
Six-year-old Christopher Tanquiri is soaking his hands in a bowl of green slime. Now, this isn't one of those science is fun classes. Chris is getting a manicure.
You want to do blue on one nail?
Actually, he's getting the Rockstar Manicure Pedicure at Spotty Da, a spa that caters to kids in Los Angeles. His mom, Maria, says she loves bringing Chris here.
It helps them realize that you do need to take care of yourself. You know, you get your hair cut and you do your nails and you feel good about yourself.
It's hard not to feel good, or at least hungry, when you see the list of Spotty Da's treatments. There is the Chocolate Kiss Facial for $60, a $25 pink lemonade pedicure, and for $40, a luxury cupcake pedicure that includes an actual cupcake. April Weiss is the spa's director of operations.
We found a lack of salons that are offering quality services for kids. So the idea started there and then evolved into, well, why not make a place where they can go and get really special manicures and pedicures and facials?
The spa industry is worth $11 billion in this country, and the number of spas in the U.S. has tripled over the last 7 years. That kind of growth can spell market saturation. So at the International Spa Summit this year, one of the major points of discussion was how to tap into newer markets, like kids. Lynn Walker-McNeese is president of the International Spa Association.
When you think about one in four American adults have been to a spa, there's a lot of children that are exposed to that through their parents.
So far, spa culture seems to have wormed its way into nearly all aspects of child marketing. Hannah Montana sells nail and bath products. Bratz Dolls offer a salon and spa playset. For you, it transforms to a nail salon. And movies like Legally Blonde and the Olsen Twins' New York Minute celebrate spa culture. And when you pepper me, know me. Even educational toy maker Scientific Explorer has options for the mathematically minded princess, including a spa chemistry set where kids make their own bath bombs. Company founder Susan Reeves says the spa kits were a no-brainer for getting girls interested in science.
Spa products are a huge, huge trend right now. We also knew that tweens were interested in this from market research that we did.
Reeves says the kits are some of the company's best sellers, and all things spa are poised to grow even more in 2008. iSpa president Lynn Walker-McNeese says historically, economic downturns have spelled boom time for spas.
The number one reason that people go to a spa is to reduce stress. You know, when the economy slows down and times are tough, we've got more stress.
And adults aren't the only ones who need a little stress relief these days. Back at Spotty Da, 13-year-olds Syra and Amina are getting their monthly treatments.
We're getting a manicure and a pedicure done.
The girls say they like the relaxation that the spa has to offer.
Depending on if there's drama in school or not.
Our school is pretty stressful.
In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, Christmas can be a time of peace and reconciliation, but I guess Denmark didn't get the memo on that. Christmas tree growers there have been accused of price fixing. The Danish Competition Office says prices have spiked 20% this year. We called Peter Christensen to ask him about it. He runs a tree farm with his brother about 250 miles west of Copenhagen.
We are accused of that almost every year, so that's nothing new.
Denmark is the largest Christmas tree exporter in Europe, and we wanted to find out how much Mr. Christensen charges for his trees. The going rate's about $40, but he didn't really give us time to ask.
I think we are going to stop this now. Okay, goodbye.
And there you have it, hung up on by a Danish Christmas tree farmer. Go figure. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 25 points, nearly 0.2%. Yeah, the guy just hung up on us. The NASDAQ rose 4 points, nearly 0.2% there as well. The S&P 500 lost 2 points. That's a 0.1% there. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, from workers to bosses, a family in Peru makes the plunge.
To have our own company, our own brand. That's not just my dream, but the dream of my father, my mother, everyone.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.